Did the commander accept the examiner's recommendation that you be enlisted as a leading mechanic?
No. No, he said I was too young to hold that rank. But the warrant officer tried still for me by saying that my theory was excellent. But I wasn't making the Navy a career. I wasn't worried about it. And I finished up as a first-class mechanic.
How long did you sign on for?
Well, I signed on then, which I understood was the shortest you could sign on for. And as we were a branch of the Royal Navy, the Royal Naval Air Service was a branch, like minesweepers or anything like that, 4 years and 4 years reserve.
So that you were officially regulars rather than hostages?
Oh, yes, yes. Our officers had the regular band and all that on their uniform and so on, plus a little eagle.
When you set out for Wormwood Scrubs by lorry from Hendon, did people cheer you in the streets?
Oh, yes. When you say cheer, they just wished us luck and waved their hands and things like that as we passed along. We had a lorry full. We were sitting alongside each other, facing the front. Planks had been put across the lorry.
It was an open lorry, not a
covered Yes. We were perched up there in our civilian clothes and going to Wormwood Scrubs to be fitted out with what naval kit was available.
What was that? What did they give you there?
Oh, they gave us what they'd got, actually. And you ready? We had our own suits. Mine was a brown with baggy trousers, big at the knees and tight at the bottoms. We were given an armband, letters RNAS, and we looked good with heavy boots, brown gaiters, peak cap, and our own suit and this armband. We also had all our naval garments, underwear, dished out. Our own was packed for dispatch back to our families.
You then went to Sheerness for basic training.
Well, we went back on the lorries to Victoria Station, then by train to Sheerness to the Naval Training School, situated at the back of the station. When we arrived, we were met by two petty officers with a truck. We had to load our hammocks and kit bags on this truck and draw and push it to the school. It was late on arrival, and we received our mess items and then taken through these huts to our beds, passing hammocks full of ratings of earlier intakes. Now I had auburn hair, and as I passed, "Get your hair cut, Ginger," was shouted at me, "Wait till the barber gets you in the morning," and remarks like that. The next day, after a bath in a large canvas bath and a haircut, we started our training, coming under, first of all, Chief Petty Officer Austin, who told us the facts of naval life, warned us about dirty women and VD, and generally broke us rookies in. Going from different chief petty officers to finish up under Corporal Lewis and Sergeant Ross of the Marines, we were taught the use of small arms, drill and early morning PT, etc., taking in all about a month. And I can assure you that my scout training came in very, very useful to me, as I could take it easy where I noticed others were struggling. I don't know.
You then went on to Felixstowe.
Yes.
Who was there a petty officer with you?
Oh, I was drafted with Petty Officer Harry Lark, who was being a friend until he died a couple of years ago, actually, and two second-class mechanics. This was on the 21st of July, 1915. To Felixstowe, experimental air station.
Could I ask about Petty Officer Lark? He wasn't a full-time Navy, was he?
No, he was a volunteer like myself. But he was a dockyard apprentice shipwright, and he had passed certain night school certificates. So he automatically became a petty officer on joining.
At Felixstowe, did you come into contact very much with Commander Port?
No, not actually, as a young mechanic. I saw him at around the station at different times. He took different parades, important parades. For example, the visit of King George V, and he flew at certain times, especially I remember seeing him flying the baby, the Port Baby aircraft. I do understand that his health was not very good, he was not very strong, but he always appeared to me to be an upright commander, and I saw no difference in him to anybody else as far as health was concerned, actually.
What did your work at Felixstowe, which I believe you said was an experimental station, did you uncrate aircraft there?
We uncrated the Curtis boats. They were brought actually on the railway lines into the station. And we uncrated the boats. I, on several occasions, was a member of the party that uncrated some of the early Curtis boats. And we found all manner of things that in their Texas shirts and things that the lads had used for padding or something, or thought we might be useful to us or something. Yes. And, of course, the early boats, for example, were, as far as I can remember, the first ones were 950 and 951. These were Curtis boats. Later we got the later improved types, like the H-12 and so on, just before I was leaving in 1917.
You also mentioned some work concerning a streamlined ladder, so you can get to upper wing.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, that's what went on. Apart from building the prototype F flying boats, which were put out when satisfactory to private firms outside to build so many, 20 or 50 or whatever it might be, we also carried out experiments to other flying boats, both Curtis and F. F stands for Felixstowe, actually. And on one occasion, for example, to one of the F flying boats, we fitted a streamlined strut covered with ply. This had a ladder inside at the widest point, and this went vertical from the hull to the top plane into a small gun pit. A gunner could climb this ladder, tight squeeze, mind you, in the strut, take his gun up and mount it. And then after firing, the idea was after firing to come back and bring his gun back with him into the hull. This was experimented with, but was not carried on. It was not, to my knowledge, fitted to any other aircraft. It was just an experiment. There was talk about fitting little motorboat floats. So if you came down, you could release one and have it as a kind of a canoe or a motorboat, things like that. But I never saw that actually carried out.
Did you see any testing of new propellers?
Oh, yes, yes. We had on one occasion a Curtiss glorified, shall I say, H-12, a new one, arrive. And they fitted to it laminated propellers with a softwood, which I believe was spruce, to a hardwood. The lamination was spruce. Then the hardwood walnut, then spruce again, and so on. Well, this machine, the engines of this machine, which were tractors, were tested in one of the big sheds near the main doors. And when opened out to somewhere about 7/8 throttle or something like that, disintegrated, the propellers disintegrated, taking off sheets of corrugated iron from the roof and just cutting two slices out of the hull at the back of the pilots. It was neatly done. The hull cuts were neatly done, really, just as though a bacon machine had just gone round and sliced it. There was no more experiments with that type of propeller, anyway, not while I was there.
Was that particular type of aircraft very popular with pilots because of the proximity of the propellers?
Not this particular one. They did. There was remarks about how close it was to the pilot's head. It was only somewhere within a foot from the back of their heads to the propeller. But they were quite safe. Those who were testing it were quite safe. They just sliced a bit out, and that's all there was to it. It gave them a nasty fright, I suppose, at the time.
You mentioned the Port Baby just now. Did you see the actual flight that was carried out by a Port Baby with a Bristol Scout on top?
Oh, yes, yes. We received the first Port Baby, which was designed by the commander, but built by, apparently, May Harden and Mays of Hythe, Southampton.
Where you later worked?
I later worked. After I left the services, I worked there for a period. We received this somewhere late in 1915. The power units consisted of two Rolls-Royce engines, tractors, port and starboard, and a green centre pusher. This was a fine-looking engine, this green, with its copper case cylinders, and was mounted on a strong engine mounting of streamlined struts. Mr. Green himself supervised the installation, and I can see him now, in my mind's eye actually, busy working around his engine, which meant something undoubtedly to him that it was a success.
He was a completely private manufacturer.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. He wasn't in the service or anything like that, no. I witnessed the handling flight, one of the handling flights, and then experiments were started with fitting small Whitehead torpedoes under the wings. Also, bomb racks in a box bay up in the bottom wings, above where the torpedoes were. And there were positions for a machine gun at junctions of the cross bracing wires. At the junction where the bracing wires of the centre section crossed, there were positions where you could put a Lewis gun on.
Would that have been remote control, or would a person...
No, a person had probably, if I remember rightly, he was up there with a belt and a cable to the flying boat, to the cockpit, and he could, if they'd passed on, he could reverse his machine gun while he was up there and, you know, things like that. From side to side, mind you, you've got to watch the engine propeller, which is a pusher in this case, the green. And as well as that, it carried a small land plane scout on the top plane. This was to act as a fighter in case of trouble if it was on patrol. That was the idea, as far as I could understand. Anyway, the night before this flight was to be taken out, the machine was already up there, I worked helping the crew rigger with some final adjustments, as I was duty watch, and we were sent anywhere on duty watch, away from what we normally done, probably. This made me very interested, and the next day I missed part of my lunch to witness, round about lunchtime, this experiment.